KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I'm a Microsoft worker, and I do not consent to my 50,000 Palestinians in Gaza have been murdered with Microsoft technology!
That's one of two Microsoft software engineers fired this week for protesting Israel's use of Microsoft's AI and cloud technology in its assault on Gaza. We'll go to Seattle to speak with one of the fired workers. But first, a Michigan lawyer, a U.S. citizen, was detained and questioned at the Detroit Metro Airport. He was forced to surrender his cell phone.
This wasn't just a search, it was intimidation. And if they can do this to me, imagine what they can do to people without legal training or a platform. This is about power, surveillance, and erosion of our rights at the border.
Then we go to a new feature film on life in the occupied West Bank. It's called The Teacher.
Welcome to our home.
How do you keep them on track in an environment like this?
Some of them stop seeing the point anymore.
She's come to see you. Maybe you can benefit from it.
You're not confined in that prison anymore. And I'm here for you. You have to finish school. Deku, please, man.
They're setting fire to the olives.
We'll speak to the director, Farah Nabulsi, and the star, Saleh Bekri. But first, the Supreme Court unanimously orders the Trump administration to facilitate the return of Kilmer Abrego Garcia to the United States. We'll get the latest. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. China's announced it's raising tariffs on U.S. products from 84 to 125% as a trade war between the two countries escalates. Beijing's retaliation came after Trump imposed a 125% tariff on China, which he says comes on top of an earlier 20% tariff for a total tariff of 145%. Chinese President Xi Jinping spoke earlier today as he met with Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez in Beijing.
China and Europe should fulfill their international responsibilities, jointly uphold the trend of economic globalization in the international trade environment, and work together to oppose unilateral bullying.
Stocks plunged again Thursday following Wednesday's market rally amidst mounting concerns over Trump's escalations with Beijing. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., Senators Adam Schiff and Ruben Gallego have called for a federal investigation into possible insider trading in Trump's White House related to his tariff orders. This is Senator Schiff.
You may have seen early in the day Trump tweet this. Yeah, this is a good time to buy. So the question is, between that tweet and Donald Trump's announcement that he was reducing the tariffs on most other nations apart from China, the question is, who knew what the president was going to do? And did people around the president trade stock knowing the incredible gyration the market was about to go through?
Among those facing scrutiny is far-right Congressmember, close Trump ally, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who invested some $750,000 in U.S. Treasury bonds in the weeks leading up to Trump's so-called Liberation Day when he announced his global tariffs. The Supreme Court has unanimously ordered the Trump administration to facilitate the return of Kilmer Abrego Garcia to the United States after the Maryland resident was denied due process rights and deported to the Cecat mega prison in El Salvador, infamous for human rights abuses, including slave labor and torture. Abrego Garcia is a husband and father of three. His family fled El Salvador in 2011 when he was 16 after gang members extorted his family and threatened to kill him. The Trump administration's admitted Abrego Garcia was removed because of an administrative error, but argued it could not bring him back because he's now in Salvador in custody. On Thursday, none of the court's nine justices dissented from an unsigned option, rejecting that argument and affirming U.S. District Judge Paula Zinnes's order that the Trump administration must facilitate and effectuate Abrego Garcia's return. But the court remained vague on how exactly this would happen. He's one of at least 278 men accused of being gang members and deported by the Trump administration to SECA without due process, many of them solely on the basis that they had tattoos. It's believed 90% of them have never been charged with a crime. Tens of thousands of people have signed a petition calling for a boycott of Avalo Airlines after the low-cost carrier signed an agreement to fly deportation flights for the Trump administration. This week, protesters rallied at Tweed New Haven Airport in Connecticut as the state's attorney general, William Tong, sent a letter to the company questioning its contract with ICE. Tong said, quote, Avalo has freely chosen to profit from and facilitate these atrocities. The state of Connecticut has an obligation now to review this business decision, unquote. A federal judge in Louisiana is set to rule today on whether the Trump administration has grounds to deport Mahmoud Khalil, a permanent U.S. resident and Columbia University graduate who helped organize campus protests against Israel's assault on Gaza. Ahead of today's ruling, Secretary of State Marco Rubio filed a brief two-page memo conceding Khalil has no criminal history and that the U.S. is seeking to deport him based purely on his beliefs. In Gaza, Israeli forces killed at least 10 people, including 7 children, today in an attack near the southern city of Khan Yunis. Separately, at least 2 Palestinians were killed in an Israeli strike in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza, where Israeli ground forces were seen blowing up and demolishing Palestinian homes and businesses as Israel expands its so-called buffer zone. Israel's siege of Gaza is now in its 40th day after it shattered the ceasefire March 2nd. Doctors Without Borders has called it a slow death for Palestinians who face severe shortages of food, water, and medicine. Israel has released a Palestinian prisoner who was held for nearly a decade after his arrest at the age of 13. In 2015, Ahmed Manasra was arrested and jailed after an altercation with 2 Israelis near an illegal settlement in occupied East Jerusalem. The settlers survived the attack. Manasra's cousin was shot dead, and Manasra was severely beaten and run over by an Israeli driver. He was convicted of attempted murder, even though he was a child at the time and carried no weapon. Family members hope he can now receive treatment for severe mental health problems he developed during his 9.5 years in prison from the age of 13. There have been more protests against Israel's assault on Gaza in California. 12 people were arrested Wednesday while blocking traffic near the Travis Air Force Base. Flights carrying U.S. weapons have departed from Travis, as have deportation flights. Meanwhile, British police arrested the head of Greenpeace UK after activists from the group Died Pond at the U.S. Embassy in London Red to protest the U.S. role in fueling, quote, an indiscriminate war that's seen bombs dropped on schools and hospitals, entire neighborhoods blasted to rubble and tens of thousands of Palestinian lives obliterated, unquote. Sudan presented its genocide case against the United Arab Emirates before the International Court of Justice Thursday.
The direct logistic and other support that the UAE has provided and continue to provide to the RSF and their affiliated militia has been continue to be the primary driving force behind genocide now taking place, including through killing, rape, forced displacement, looting, and the destruction of public and private properties.
The UAE rejected the charges and called on the International Court of Justice to throw out the case. The World Court can take years to deliver a final ruling on such cases, but can issue emergency measures that are meant to prevent further escalation. The devastating war between the Sudanese army and the Rapid Support Forces is nearing its 2-year mark, April 15th. All parties to the conflict have been accused of gross human rights violations and war crimes. A new Amnesty International report details sexual violence used as a weapon of war by RSF fighters against women and girls as young as 15. The UK's defense minister has called on other Ukrainian allies to move ahead with the joint armed presence in Ukraine to ensure any forthcoming peace agreement with Russia is implemented. The meeting of the self-described coalition of the willing comes as Ukraine has accused Russia of stalling on a ceasefire deal and of preparing for a major military push. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is joining his counterparts virtually at the Brussels meeting amidst uncertainty over U.S. support for the coalition's plans. Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, is in Russia today for talks with the Kremlin. Meanwhile, talks between U.S. and Ukrainian officials on a minerals for security deal are also expected to start today. Back in the U.S., the Republican-led House passed a bill Thursday to require documentary proof of U.S. citizenship to register to vote in federal elections. Under the SAVE Act, voters would have to produce a passport, birth certificate, or naturalization papers, a requirement critics say will disenfranchise millions. The move would effectively end voter registration by mail and online. Anyone who has changed their last name after marriage or for other reasons could be barred from voting if their citizenship documents don't match their current ID. Rural and low-income voters are also less likely to have access to these documents. The bill is not expected to garner the necessary 60 votes to pass in the Senate. President Trump's ordered the Justice Department to investigate two officials from his first term who publicly pushed back against Trump's lies about fraud in the 2020 election. Trump accused one of the officials, former Homeland Security Chief of Staff Miles Taylor, of treason. The other target is former head of U.S. cybersecurity, Chris Krebs. Trump also revoked security clearances for Taylor and Krebs. Miles Taylor wrote on social media in response, quote, "Dissent isn't unlawful. It certainly isn't treasonous. America is headed down a dark path," he said. A group of House Democrats are ramping up pressure to force Elon Musk out of the White House by May 30th, which will mark the end of the legally permitted 130-day term of what's called special government employees. This is Texas Congressmember Greg Kassar.
Trump and Musk have exploited Musk's designation as a so-called special government employee to allow Musk to receive over $8 million a day in federal government contracts and subsidies while ignoring our conflict of interest rules and while funneling more and more money to himself and to his companies.
Democrats say Musk should not be allowed to return as a special government employee for at least a year and must first divest from his companies, including Tesla and SpaceX. House Republicans passed a Senate and Trump-approved budget framework Thursday, fast-tracking a plan to cut $4 trillion in taxes for the wealthy and another $1.5 trillion in spending, largely targeting essential services like Medicaid and nutrition assistance. In the Dominican Republic, the death toll from a Santo Domingo nightclub roof collapse Tuesday has topped 220 people. Among the victims of the disaster were the beloved merengue singer Ruby Perez and two former Major League Baseball players, Octavio Dotel and Tony Blanco. And in New Zealand, a hotly contested bill which would have rolled back indigenous Maori rights has been defeated. The measure, which sought to reinterpret the Treaty of Waitangi, was met with widespread protests both on the streets and inside parliament, led by indigenous lawmakers. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a unanimous ruling, the Supreme Court's ordered the Trump administration to facilitate the return of Kilmar Abrego Garcia to the United States after the Maryland resident husband and father of three with no criminal record was denied due process rights and sent to the notorious Secat prison in El Salvador. But the court remained vague on how exactly this would happen, and the Trump administration has claimed it has no way of ensuring his safe return. This comes as a federal immigration judge in Louisiana is set to rule today on whether the Trump administration has grounds to deport Mahmoud Khalil, a permanent resident of the United States and Columbia University graduate student who played a key role in organizing campus protests against Israel's assault on Gaza. Ahead of today's ruling, Secretary of State Marco Rubio filed a short memo that concedes Khalil has no criminal history and argues he should be deported as part of U.S. efforts to combat anti-Semitism. For more, we're joined in New York by Ramzi Kassem, part of Mahmoud Khalil's legal team, professor of law at the City University of New York, or CUNY, where he founded and co-directs CLEAR, a legal clinic. The acronym stands for Creating Law Enforcement Accountability and Responsibility. Ramzi, welcome back to Democracy Now! Let's first look at this unanimous Supreme Court ruling that Kilmer must be returned from El Salvador, or at least the U.S. must facilitate this. What exactly does this mean?
Good morning, Amy. Thank you for having me. Yeah, the decision in Mr. Abrego Garcia's case is, you know, a bittersweet win for him and his family, of course. You know, he's been taken away from them in such an unjust and cruel fashion and taken to one of the most notorious facilities in El Salvador. The decision confirms that the government needs to facilitate, but asks the lower court to clarify what it meant when it said that the U.S. government should effectuate. And that's just a reference to the limits of the U.S. government's power to control the actions of a foreign sovereign here, El Salvador. So it may take some time. The bottom line is that it may take some time because, of course, the U.S. government cannot order another government to do anything now that it has put Mr. Abrego Garcia in this position. But it is still a step in the right direction and hopefully will lead to his return home to his family, or at least, unfortunately, to immigration detention in the United States while the government works out its theory for why he should be removed, even though he received legal protection in the past.
And can you talk about your own client? Can you talk about Mahmoud Khalil, a Louisiana judge ruling today exactly on what? Could the judge rule that Mahmoud could be freed?
Well, Amy, you know, the government's strategy in Mr. Khalil's case, and actually across the board in these cases where the government has outrageously detained student activists in the United States, including permanent residents like Mr. Khalil, simply for speaking up in defense of Palestinian rights and lives, their strategy in many of these cases has been to speed up and accelerate the removal cases, the administrative immigration cases, because that is the court that they fully control. Every immigration judge serves at the pleasure of the president, and simultaneously to slow down the federal habeas corpus cases that the prisoners themselves, men like Mr. Khalil and Ms. Oesterk, have brought in federal court to challenge the constitutionality of their detention, to tie up those federal cases and jurisdictional issues. So what's happening in Louisiana in immigration court is symptomatic of that strategy. Immigration cases very rarely, in my experience, move this quickly. I've never seen one move this quickly through the system. So that's already not a good sign. That's a sign that there may be some political interference. Now, the immigration judge today is supposed to rule on removability, whether or not Mr. Khalil is deportable. Of course, theoretically, if she finds that he is not deportable under the government's charges, then, you know, she should set him free. But I think we should be focused on the other alternative, which is that the immigration judge will find him removable, that she will agree with potentially the government's argument that Marco Rubio's two-page memo is all that she needs to find him removable, and that she cannot interrogate the Secretary of State's finding in that two-page memo that Mr. Khalil and another individual whose name is redacted, that their very presence or activities or their speech constitutes such a problem for U.S. foreign policy somehow that they have to be deported. Now, that is the government's position, that all it needs is that two-pager to put someone like Mr. Khalil, who is a permanent resident with a U.S. citizen wife who's expecting their first child this month, behind bars and to remove them from the country that they call home. And if the immigration judge agrees with that position, that would be another outrage and a long series of outrages in Mr. Khalil's case as he continues to fight for his freedom in federal court.
I want to thank you for being with us, Ramzi Kassem, part of the legal team representing Mahmoud Khalil, professor of law at the City University of New York, known as CUNY. He co-directs CLEAR, a legal clinic creating law enforcement accountability and responsibility. As we turn to another lawyer right now, on Thursday, ICE deleted a post on X with a graphic that said, quote, "If it crosses the border illegally, it's our job to stop it." and showed the words people, money, products, and ideas. This week, Homeland Security said it's now surveilling the social media posts of international students and immigrants for alleged anti-Semitic activity. Amidst the crackdown on international students who exercised their free speech rights during Palestinian Solidarity campus protests last year, new felony vandalism and conspiracy charges that are some of the harshest yet were filed Thursday against 11 Stanford University students and one former student involved in a building takeover last June. Meanwhile, on Sunday, Customs and Border Protection at the Detroit Metro Airport detained a lawyer, a U.S. citizen, representing a pro-Palestinian protester facing a felony charge stemming from an encampment at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. Civil rights attorney Amir Makhled and his family were returning from a spring break trip when he was detained and asked about his clients and asked to hand over his cell phone. He's based in Dearborn, Michigan, and is joining us now. Welcome to Democracy Now, Amir. Explain exactly what happened.
Well, good morning, Amy. Thank you. What happened is I was returning home from spring break with my wife and kids. And as I approached the passport control desk, an agent asked if there was a TTRT agent available. I didn't know what that acronym meant, so I did a Google search. And it meant Tactical Terrorism Response Team. That's when another agent summoned me to and my family members to a secondary screening room. And at that point, I was separated from my family. My wife and children were allowed to continue and leave. But what happened next was quite interesting to me. It didn't seem as if this was a random stop or a routine search. This was targeted. The special agent that approached was wearing plain clothes. He knew who I was. He knew that I was an attorney. And he knew that I had been representing, individuals in high-profile cases as of late, which was a reference to the case of Samantha Lewis. Samantha is one of my clients who has been charged in the encampment at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. At that moment, the agent asked if my cell phone was with me. I said yes. And he handed me a pamphlet. The pamphlet had an explanation of the federal statute that allows for at the border for federal agents to seize my communication device, my telephone. I told him I wasn't ready to give up my phone because my phone contains a lot of confidential information and probably over a decade worth of emails and text messages and files from my work as an attorney. At that point, he brought in a supervisor, and the supervisor indicated to me that if I write down on a legal pad everything that I believe could be privileged, we won't go through that. Otherwise, we're taking your device. Knowing that the government could take my device, I still pushed back and said, no, I'm not going to engage the government in this exercise of writing down what could be confidential and what could be privileged information. That's a futile exercise, an impossibility to do in this setting. Last, they come back to me and say, look, if you show us your contact list, we'll give you your phone back. Otherwise, we're taking it. And so at that point, I acquiesced. I said, okay, I didn't want my device to be taken by the government because in other cases, I've known that the government could take your phone for days, weeks, or even years in some extreme cases. So I didn't want to be in that position where I didn't have my device. And once it was outside of my control and custody, who knows what the government could do with all the information that was contained in regards to my client's information. They came back with a list of questions about individuals on my contact list. That's when I said this has gone too far. I cannot divulge whether individuals on my contact list are going to be clients, friends, or otherwise. So I told them this: whoever's in my phone is going to be a client, a friend, or a family member, and that's all I'm going to engage in. And the reason why I feel that this was a targeted approach is because they knew my history. They knew my travel history. They knew that I had been traveled overseas several times in the past years. They had a whole profile about me. And that showed to me that this wasn't something that was random. This wasn't a routine search. This was targeted. And the fact that they brought up my cases, including the high-profile case that I'm involved in right now, showed and was, to me, an intimidation attempt. It was an attempt to dissuade. And when I look at what the current administration is doing, they're attacking attorneys. They're attacking immigration lawyers in federal court for what they claim to be as frivolous filings for asylum seekers. They're attacking big law firms in Washington, D.C., through executive orders. And so this is another example of our current administration pushing back and trying to stop the individuals who are speaking up on the war in Gaza. Our client in this situation, Samantha Lewis, has decided to take a position in the University of Michigan encampment case to fight back. That case is involving the criminalization of free speech. None of those students were engaged in anything that was violent. They were peaceful demonstrations with an encampment. And the campus safety police came in with a very strong showing of force, wearing riot gear, holding batons, and engaging in mace and other type of chemical repellents, and started busting up this encampment as they were walking in unison in riot gear. And whatever was in their way, whether it was a tent, a desk, a chair, these officers were using their batons and showing force and destroying anything in their path. And that included protesters. And those who resisted that were charged with felonies.
Now, I mean, is the border some kind of no man's land? You're a U.S. citizen. You're an attorney. Our phones now contain so much information, it's like police coming to your home and demanding to get in, right, for into your office. Do they require
Absolutely.
A warrant? And why didn't they in your case? You are a U.S. citizen and you're a lawyer.
I was born in Detroit, Michigan. They do not require a warrant. They can have a warrantless search without probable cause, without any reasonable suspicion. The statute at the border gives a wide range of authority for government to seize devices. Now, it's supposed to be done in the sense of national security. That's the claim. But at this point, everything has been, as you could see from the current administration, even political dissenters are now looked at as a threat to national security. Somebody who protests the war on Gaza is a threat to national security. So it could be anything. But the question becomes, of these warrantless searches and of all the devices that the government has seized in the years that they've been doing this, what has led to actual convictions? And I don't believe that the government even knows what that figure is. It's an unreasonable search, and it's a trample on our constitutional rights at the border. Our rights shouldn't be stripped at the border crossings. We shouldn't have the ability to have the protections of the Fourth Amendment because we're entering back into the United States at a border crossing. My advice to anybody traveling that's worried about government getting into their data is to take a different device without all of your data on your phone. You'd have to almost travel with a burner phone, and for lack of a better word. This is the only way that you can adequately protect yourself from not having your phone confiscated, because they have the right to do it.
And at this point, do you know exactly what they took from your phone?
No, I would have no idea. I gave them only authority to look at my contact list. In fact, I wrote it down and I said, only my contact list is not going to be what I claim to be privileged. And whether or not they took information outside of that, I would have no idea.
So what do you recommend to people who are not lawyers and are traveling? Most people don't even know what a burner phone is and require what's in their phones to contact people.
So my recommendation is, don't unlock your phones. If you're coming through the border, keep your phone off. And if an agent does request a secondary screening and your phone is subject to a search, you can keep your phone turned off. You don't have to give them your password. You don't have to give them facial recognition. You don't have to comply with opening your phone and showing agents what's in your phone. And if they do decide to confiscate your phone, there are redress programs. There is an ability to get it back. The question is how long. And those are the CBP policy, Customs and Border Protection policy, indicates that the actual confiscation of a phone has to be done in the most extreme cases where there is a high level of national security concern. Now, we don't know exactly what that test is. It's not a bright line rule, and most individuals coming through the United States should not be, especially as citizens, considered as a national security threat. But, you know, at this point, we have no idea.
Amir Maklid, I want to thank you for being with us, Michigan-based civil rights lawyer, U.S. citizen, defending a pro-Palestinian activist at the University of Michigan encampment. He was detained and questioned Sunday at the Detroit Metro Airport when coming in from a family vacation in the Dominican Republic. Asked about his clients, told he had to surrender his cell phone. When we come back, we speak with one of two Microsoft software engineers fired this week for protesting Israel's use of Microsoft AI and cloud technology and its assault on Gaza. And then we'll look at a new film that's premiering tonight. It's called The Teacher. Stay with us. Tómame tus brazos y embriágame de amor. Y llena mis sentidos de ti. Pon tu boca pequeña dentro de la mía. Y dame un beso sin fin. Quítame el aliento de tanto amar y amar. Y no me dejes pensar. Echa fuera de mi pecho este amor que aún le tengo. Abrígame, consuélame, libérame de este sufrimiento. Y hazme olvidarla, por favor, hazme olvidarla. Hazme sentir que no es la única mujer. Borra sus huellas de mi mente, de mi alma. Dominican singer and songwriter Ruby Perez performed Hazme Olvidar, Make Me Forget. The legendary merengue musician was one of more than 220 people killed Tuesday when a roof collapsed at a Santo Domingo nightclub where he was performing. He was 69 years old. Also among the dead, Octavio Dotel and Tony Blanco, two Major League Baseball players. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at how Microsoft fired two software engineers this week after they protested Israel's use of Microsoft's AI and cloud technology in its assault on Gaza. A recent investigation by the Associated Press revealed the Israeli military used this technology to select bombing targets in Gaza and Lebanon. Leaked documents obtained by The Guardian and Drop Site News earlier this year showed the extent to which the Israeli military was using Microsoft cloud computing platform and how its use of Microsoft's AI technology spiked dramatically in the months following October 7, 2023. The protest began last Friday at Microsoft's 50th anniversary celebrations as Microsoft AI CEO Mustafa Suleiman presented product updates to an audience that included Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates. This is software engineer Ibtihal Abusad, who organizes with the Microsoft employee-led campaign No Azure for Apartheid, disrupting and confronting Suleiman.
Profiteer. Stop using AI for genocide, Mustafa. Stop using AI for genocide in our region. You have blood on your hands. All of Microsoft has blood on its hands. How dare you all celebrate when Microsoft is killing children? Shame on you all.
Thank you. I hear your protest. Thank you.
The second protest at Microsoft's 50th anniversary celebrations was led by Microsoft software developer Vanya Agarwal, who interrupted a discussion between Bill Gates, former CEO Steve Ballmer, and the current CEO, Satya Nadella.
Shame on you all. You're all hypocrites. I'm a Microsoft worker, and I do not consent to my...
Thank you.
50,000 Palestinians in Gaza have been murdered with Microsoft technology.
Thank you.
How dare you? Shame on all of you for celebrating on their blood. Cut ties with Israel. No Azure for apartheid. Microsoft AI kills kids. Microsoft powers genocide.
Both of the Microsoft workers who protested were fired this week. In October, Microsoft also fired two workers for helping organize an unauthorized lunchtime vigil for Palestinian refugees at its headquarters. For more, we're joined by one of the fired workers, Vanya Agarwal. She is in Seattle. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Can you start off by talking about exactly what you did, Vanya, and why you did it?
Yeah, good morning, Amy, and thank you so much for having me. So just a little background, throughout 2025, Microsoft has been celebrating its 50th year anniversary using message centered around its philanthropist impact. But every month, we continue to learn more and more about how Microsoft and its services have enabled and accelerated the genocide in Gaza. As you mentioned, there have been multiple investigations by news outlets, including The Guardian, AP, DropSite News, and others. And the response from Microsoft on all of this has shed light on its hypocrisy. They declined to comment on the investigations. They evaded questions internally. They delete comments from workers asking for explanations. They remove peaceful protesters from premises. And like you mentioned, they even fired two of our members last October. So our campaign, No Azure for Apartheid, felt no celebration should be allowed while Microsoft is playing an active role in the genocide of Palestinians in Gaza. So that's why our campaign decided to protest their 50th anniversary event. But to be clear, this was a very coordinated and planned protest. Although Iftihel and I have been the public faces of the disruptions, this protest wouldn't have happened without all the names and hands behind the campaign. So as part of the protest, we disrupted the keynote event. Iftihel disrupted the head of AI at Microsoft, Mustafa, and I disrupted the Microsoft CEOs, including Bill Gates, Satya Nadella, and Steve Ballmer. After both of our disruptions, we each blasted internal emails to thousands of Microsoft employees with three goals. We wanted everyone to know that Microsoft's cloud and AI are the bombs and bullets of the 21st century. We wanted to make our demands of Microsoft loud and clear that they must disclose and divest from the IOF, call for a permanent ceasefire, and protect the free speech of their employees. And we wanted to encourage others to take action. In a company that has a footprint in all major military infrastructures in Israel, all workers are complicit, and everybody has a part to play.
Vanya, how much support do you have among workers, and who feels they can protest and who doesn't? Are people right now concerned, especially international workers?
Yeah, that's a good question. I believe if there's one thing we've seen in reaction to our protests, it's just that we're not alone. The Microsoft workers are outraged. We've all been misled into developing and supporting weapons under the guise of AI for good, and we're already seeing Microsoft workers take action. Workers everywhere began actions in protest of Microsoft's direct complicity and in response to a global call to action from Gaza for a strike and civil disobedience. So earlier this week, these workers refused to work and sent status messages expressing refusal to have their labor go to Microsoft's war profiteering. And just last week, Microsoft was also designated as one of the priority boycott targets of the BDS movement. And so we've seen tons of people everywhere making material impacts by answering this call to pressure Microsoft and hold these billionaire war criminals accountable. Even across within Microsoft itself, we're seeing workers call out Microsoft and its executives across their social platforms, shutting down job posting for AI roles at Microsoft, and even forcing Microsoft to turn off and hide comments on all of their 50th anniversary content. So Microsoft's image is really tarnished. The world now sees that they're hypocrites and they can't hide behind their philanthropy, their mission, or their prestige any longer. As far as who is able to take action, I know that I recognize my privilege and my position in being able to take a loud stand like this, and not everybody can do that without putting so much on the line, their jobs, their families, their homes. It's really scary times. But there are ways to be involved and to take action without putting yourself in the line of fire. Like I mentioned, our protest was a coordinated and planned effort. There were so many folks working behind the scenes that made it happen. And grassroots movements like this have such a variety of needs and roles that assume different levels of risk. And, you know, in the same line of thought, we have power in our numbers. Resistance isn't a solitary endeavor, and it only survives in the arms of the collective. So for this campaign, I would really urge everyone to get involved however they can, answer BDS calls, to apply pressure to Microsoft, build community and get involved, sign petitions from campaigns like ours to hold these companies accountable. And for those willing to assume a little more risk, demand that your workplaces divest from Israel, refuse to have your labor apartheid, genocide, and refuse to have your labor power apartheid and genocide. And for those who can't assume risk, no action is small in this movement. Even things like making a PB&J sandwich for mutual aid is a form of resistance.
Vanya, we just have a minute. No Azure for apartheid is your slogan. Can you explain it further? What is Azure for people who are not in the know?
Yeah, so Azure is Microsoft's cloud technology. And Azure itself is provides services and platforms and tools for Microsoft's customers to build their own services and products and tools, and also to get support from Microsoft itself.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll certainly continue to follow what's happening at Microsoft. Vanya Agrawal, organizer with No Azure for Apartheid, former Microsoft worker, joined with another protester protesting Microsoft, Israel's use of Microsoft technology in its assault on Gaza, more than 50,000, and it's expected that's a serious undercount. Palestinians have been killed there in this latest attack since October 2023. Next up, the director and star of the new Palestinian feature film, The Teacher. It premieres tonight. Stay with us. Fading Memory, composed by Alex Baranowski for the new film, The Teacher. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to a feature film about the many challenges of life in the occupied West Bank. It follows a Palestinian school teacher struggling between his commitment to resistance and supporting one of his students. The film is called The Teacher. It was made and premiered at festivals before October 7, 2023, but it's only being released in the United States this week. This is the trailer.
I'm looking for one of your students, Yaqub Haddad.
Yaqub Haddad!
Great, Miss United Nations has arrived.
Welcome to our home.
How do you keep them on track in an environment like this?
Some of them stop seeing the point anymore.
She's come to see you. Maybe you can benefit from it.
You're not confined in that prison anymore. And I'm here for you. You have to finish school. Yaqub, please, man.
They're setting fire to the olives.
How's Adam doing?
Lost.
I will work on this case, but it is not often that the state will bring criminal charges.
Have some hope and hold on to it.
But after everything you've been through, you still believe there'll be justice?
We're under huge pressure, otherwise we would not have brought him here.
24-year-old IDF soldier Nathaniel Cohen abducted over 3 years ago.
Spies are everywhere, and informants are singing their lungs out.
He's that captured soldier, right?
You cannot tell a soul about this. No one, do you hear me?
I understand. I'm with you.
The lives of over 1,000 prisoners depend on that one soldier.
We will use every means possible to find him.
He knew he was getting away with it. They all did. I swear he killed my brother.
Revenge eats away at you and destroys you from the inside, and it resolves absolutely nothing.
There are things I'll never be able to share with you. I'm chained to my past.
Martin.
Give me the gun, Adam.
Adam!
Mobilize a team for Bulin.
Smoke them out.
They'll keep him alive as long as it takes.
How do you know that?
Because they know that your people believe your son is worth thousands of mine.
The trailer for The Teacher, a new feature film, premiering tonight in New York at the Angelika. It's directed by the BAFTA-winning, Oscar-nominated Palestinian-British filmmaker Farah Nabulsi, and stars the acclaimed Palestinian actor Salah Bekri, who's both joining us in our New York studio today. Being there last night was amazing at the Angelika before the big premiere tonight. Farah, talk about making this film. You also wrote it, you directed it, and you actually did this years ago over a period of years and made the film, but only premiering it now.
Yeah, I wrote the film about 5 years ago. We shot it in militarily occupied, colonized Palestine approximately 2.5 years ago, and it premiered September 2023, as you mentioned. You know, you're shooting in territory that is a place of apartheid. It's a place where you have illegal Israeli settlers. That kind of vandalism and violence every day that Palestinians endure. And you're trying to do justice to that reality as that reality is unfolding around you in real time. So it was a very difficult process. An example is that in the film, as you see in the trailer, we have a moment where there is a home demolition. But on my way to work one morning, I passed by a couple with their 6 children on the side of the road in front of the rubble of their freshly demolished home. So it's a fiction narrative, this film, but it is deeply, deeply rooted in the reality. And we struggled on many levels. You know, the normal pragmatic things of checkpoints and roadblocks, but really dealing with the oppression and the very blatant abuse and humiliation of Palestinians is something that weighs on you when you're trying to carry out cinema.
I want to go to a clip of the film, The Teacher. Bassem, played by our guest today, Palestinian actor Salah Bekri, is in his classroom speaking to his student Yaqub, who'd just been released from an Israeli prison after serving a 2-year sentence over his involvement in a protest.
Wait for me. I'll find you outside.
You can't hand in work like this. It's clear you made no effort. I know this year has been tough, settling back in. But remember, this is a chance to get back control of your life. And you're just wasting it. Have another go, and there's no shame in asking your brother if you need help.
Early in the film, in The Teacher, Israeli soldiers demolish the home where Yaqub and his brother Adam live with their mother. Their teacher, Bassem, comes to visit them on the land where the brothers' home once stood. Yaqub and Adam are sitting on a couch amidst the rubble of what was once their home.
Guys, I want to talk to you. How have things been at your uncle's place?
Amazing. Stuffed in one bedroom with our 4 cousins.
Nothing nicer than sharing a room with 4 pubescents.
I've been meaning to ask you about the payment for the demolition.
Mom's trying to figure it out. Our uncle can't afford.
Let them go to hell. Drinks from the Sea of Gaza.
I hope this is enough.
Thank you. There's no way our mother will accept this. No way.
Tell her it's for all the gardening you did for me in the old days. You earned it.
Okay.
Great, Miss United Nations has arrived.
She's come to see you. Maybe you can benefit from it.
Player!
Hello, Miss Lisa. Welcome to our home.
You're not confined in that prison anymore. So now you seize this. You have to finish school. I know it's not easy, but the alternative, Yakub, is not something that I think you want. You just have to focus. Yakub, please, man.
Yakub is picking up binoculars in the scene. He sees a group of Israeli settlers from afar setting fire to several olive trees. He gets up and runs toward them. His younger brother Adam follows him as Yakub confronts the Israeli settlers, one of whom shoots Yakub in the chest, killing him. You play the teacher, Salah Bakri. You play the star of this film, and you are Palestinian yourself. We're seeing Palestinians killed, we're seeing settler violence, we're seeing demolition of homes. How was that for you to manifest as an actor?
You know, in our work, the tragedies we are living, we turn it into this energy that we get from the tragedies that we are confronting and that we are experiencing, it's an energy that we can turn it into a creative energy, a creative in a creative way, and that's the privilege of art, that we can turn the sad reality and the difficult reality into something creative, into something that we can share with all humanity. And in a way, this form of resistance art in all its aspects, whether it is cinema, theater, painting, any kind of art, it's a form of resistance that in the same time it cures the soul, our souls. It cures us from falling into you know, feelings that distracts you, or feelings that make you blind, you know, like hatred or anything like that. So it is a continuous struggle and a continuous resistance of this reality.
Where were you born?
I was born in Jaffa.
Where do you live now?
Haifa.
So you filmed this before October 2023. And yet here you are traveling the country and the United States as you premiere this film, from what was happening then to what's happening today. Gaza, well over 50,000 people killed, the intensification and violence in the West Bank. What are your thoughts on that?
I am privileged. I can move. And I use this privilege. You know, the occupation wants us separated. And I fight this separation. I'm not an alien in my homeland. I am part of this people. And I want to break this siege they put on us, and I want to go to Gaza. I want to work in Gaza. I want to do theater in Gaza. I want to do cinema in Gaza. I'm not allowed. People in the West Bank are not allowed to come to Haifa to see my work in Haifa. So we are scattered all around, not able or not allowed to gather and to work together, to learn from each other, to tell our story in a way, in a perfect way, in a way that in a complete way. You know, it's, you know, I'm not different from anybody who lives in the West Bank or in Gaza or in a refugee camp in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan. So I wanna dismantle these checkpoints, these borders all around Palestine, and to come together. I dream of Palestinians coming together again, living their life, doing art, doing music together, telling their stories to the world, to themselves, learning from each other, and teaching the world. This is my fight. This is my struggle, and this is our struggle, our collective struggle. So being here is part of it. You know, I'm privileged to be here. The people in Gaza for more than 18 years now are segregated. They are in a prison, maybe the biggest prison open prison on earth, and they are facing a genocide. And we are facing it, all of us, and we are there. I feel maybe during these 2 years, I felt that maybe the best place, the place I wanted to be most is in Gaza, not anywhere else, not here. I want to be in Gaza now, you know, just to be with the people. And to be there, just to be there, to hug the mothers, the kids, the children, the fathers, and to try to do something on earth. I feel paralyzed. And you know, I even find it hard to just comprehend what I am as a Palestinian is dealing with. What is it? How it inflicts me? What would come out of me after that? You know. So and we. For me, Israel must held accountable for for the crimes it's done, not only in Gaza today. Since 1948 until today, they made crimes upon the continuous crimes since 1948 that they didn't held accountable, and that's why they are doing what they are doing now. And I hope that this genocide is the end of it. It's the end of the Zionist regime in Palestine.
More than 10 years ago, we had your father at this table, Mohammed Bakri, when he was facing jail for his documentary called Janine, Janine. But before we end, I wanted to ask you, Farah, about that theme that runs through this of 1,000 Palestinians freed for one Israeli hostage.
You know, I think it comes back to a little bit about what you were asking, Saleh. This morning, I was looking out my window and I was thinking the equivalent, when we think about imbalance in value for human life. This is a story inspired by, in 2011, an Israeli occupation soldier was exchanged for over 1,000 Palestinian political prisoners, hundreds of whom were women and children, hundreds of whom were being held in administrative detention, which, as you know, is without trial or charge. And that just seemed like such a massive imbalance.
We have 20 seconds.
But today we can see there is no value for Palestinian life. And the equivalent in New York would be around 1 million Palestinians or 1 million New Yorkers being brutally killed, blinded, burned, and 8 million displaced Where's the value?
I want to thank you both for being with us. Farhan Nabulsi, BAFTA-winning, Oscar-nominated British-Palestinian director, and Saleh Bakri.